The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning. How are you?
Boker Tov, I'm happy to hear you're not sensitive, Howard, because I've got this thing. I don't know if Zanati's got it, but when you say Zanati Guma, it doesn't sound right. Zanati needs to start getting you into
Anthony. Wow.
I forgave him a long time ago.
Okay, hold on. Can we just then can we clarify that?
Guma.
Zanati Guma.
Oh, woo.
Whoa, that came out of my mouth.
Oh my goodness.
Zanati Guma. No.
I think your Kenyan ancestry just...
it just came through.
Yeah.
It never comes through when I'm running.
What?
But now it just
I'm impressed. I actually didn't know that you could make
No, you see, now I'm self-conscious.
But at least you're making the click.
Oh, so
here he goes, Zanati. You know that he can do it,
wow.
Right? So it's just a little bit of practice.
I really didn't know that he could. I didn't know that he had it in him.
Of course, I've got Kenyan in me. Zanati, time is 7:47. Wow. Wow, imagine if I were sensitive. All right, Anthony, let's start off not a nicer topic. Unfortunately, children at a pool party were sent scrambling to protective shelters last night. That was after code red sirens were sounded in the Gaza border area. All right, tell us, what was the source? What happened here?
Well, this was a pool party. Apparently, 80 youngsters in the pool at a moshav. It's kind of the end of the summer. For school children, school begins again on Sunday. And so this is the time now when everybody's going to make up for what they haven't managed to do during the last 2 months of summer holidays. The Moshav in Netiv HaAsara was hosting this pool party when about 9 o'clock last night, all of a sudden code red sirens were sounded, and you could imagine children outside in the pool scrambling into protective shelters. It seems as if though somehow the protective shelters managed to accommodate the children. There was a bit of panic. According to the people on the ground at the swimming pool, this is going to be a pool party that these children will not forget in a hurry. Fortunately, no injuries, no damage. The rocket that was fired from Gaza apparently didn't even make it across the border. So even though it did create a little bit of consternation at that pool party, fortunately everything sort of turned out well in the end. But it does demonstrate a few things. First of all, the kind of lives that these children are having to live with in terms of being consciously, constantly aware of what's going on around them and being, having to be ready to scramble to protective shelters at a moment's notice. And also to a different extent, the level of sensitivity that there is. When people hear a code red siren, there is no time to hesitate. There is no, absolutely no flinching at all. It seems as if though the people are so well drilled, they've got it so in their instincts just to move towards these protective shelters. So luckily everything was okay on that occasion. Of course, the children will go back to school on Sunday. The schools do have protective areas. And so obviously the government has taken care to make sure at least that the children in the schools are looked after. But clearly still a great deal of sensitivity around the Gaza border area. There was very limited retaliation from the IDF. They did attack a number of targets within the northern Gaza Strip. I don't think it's going to be anything that will make any real difference to the situation other than for the IDF to carry out their stated policy of responding to every single rocket that's fired and every single incident that happens with some response, with some retaliation, even though this retaliation seems to be very, very limited. And one wonders whether it was even worthwhile because the forces in Gaza, the administration in Gaza already knows as soon as a rocket is fired that there will be a retaliation. I'm not exactly sure how they work out where this retaliation will be, but there seems to be kind of some sort of a, I don't want to say coordination, but it almost seems to be kind of coordinated in a sense because the retaliation really was nothing of any significance. So, you know, that's where we stand at the moment. Situation remains tense. Once again, you know, Hamas are claiming that this was not of their making. The Israeli security services seem to believe Hamas, seem to have evidence to support the fact that they are not the ones behind the most recent rocket attacks, even though The attacks are coming from Gaza, which is under Hamas's administration and control, but nonetheless, it is not instigated by Hamas. And so there is at least some agreement between Hamas and the Israeli security services on that. And of course, now the focus will turn towards Friday, what will happen on the Gaza border. And then, of course, after that to Sunday, when I think about 2 million Israeli children will be back at school. And, of course, the current standoff that we have every year between the teachers' union and the Ministry of Finance over terms and conditions for teachers. There have been threats of a strike, as there is always at the beginning of the school year, both in the lower school area, the primary schools, as well as the high schools. I'm not sure how serious that threat really is and what the current standoff relates to, how serious that is between the teachers' union and the Ministry of Finance. But it's an annual event where threats are issued each way. The school year will not begin on time. Parents will be put under pressure because the children will not return to school. There have been situations in the past when there have been extended strikes at the beginning of the school year in order for the teachers' union to make their point. I have to say the teachers deserve a much better teaching conditions than they currently have to operate within. I think that's a given. That's, I think, recognized by most people around. Unfortunately, there doesn't really seem to be any significant progress towards improving their terms and conditions, which they do deserve. On the other hand, the school children are held to ransom if they're going to strike as a result of trying to make their demands. So certainly the attention will now turn to Sunday morning, when it will be what they like to call in Israel Shalom Kita Aleph, which is the first day of the school year, when of course the Kita Aleph, the grade one kids, will return to, will go to school for the first time. And so Shalom Kita Aleph is the term that's used for the first day of the school year, and particularly with so reference cute. To the yeah. new children who are starting school.
That's lovely. That's really, really great. And the Israeli is now the top ranked judoka in the world. This is incredible. I mean, obviously some of the footage coming out of that not so wonderful, but what an achievement.
This comes from Tokyo. Sagi Muki won the gold medal at the Judo World Championships that took place in Tokyo yesterday. And even though Israeli judoka have received, have won gold medals and other medals at the Olympic Games and the other competitions, this is actually the very first time that an Israeli judoka has won a medal, or at least a gold medal, at the World Championships. And the fact that it's in Tokyo is, of course, very significant because the Olympic Games will take place exactly there at that location where the World Championships took place just this week. And so Sagi Muki not only is the gold medalist at the Judo World Championships of 2019, but he is also the highest ranked judoka in the world. And I think that's an amazing achievement for him, and of course for Israeli judo in general, with Hatikva being played in Tokyo with the Israeli flag being waved, of course, during that ceremony. But as you alluded to, his path to the final wasn't all that easy. There was a situation where there was an Iranian judoka who refused in the earlier rounds, who had refused to compete against him. There is a lot of speculation that the individual sportsmen and women from Iran would quite like to compete against their Israeli counterparts, given the opportunity to. But there is so much pressure on them from the regime, from behind the scenes, from the sports governing body in Iran, and potentially, therefore, behind that from the administration itself, that these competitors are not allowed to compete against Israeli opponents. And, of course, this was the case as well with Sagi Muki on his way up to the final. And of course, when he competed against the Egyptian in the later rounds, and he beat the Egyptian quite comfortably, the Egyptian then decided not to shake hands, which of course is the sportsmanlike thing to do at the end of competition, even if you are the loser. So it was a little unfortunate because, of course, with our Egyptian friends, we do have formal relations and the governments do compete with each other, and yet there is still this antagonism that we see at an individual level, which is very unfortunate indeed. That actually happened in the quarterfinal round, but you know, who really cares? Because here we go, Sagi beat his Belgian rival to become the world champion and to become the highest ranked in the world. So I think that's a great achievement, and we simply hope that he'll be able to maintain the current fitness and focus in order to do well in the Olympic Games next year at the same location.
I mean, is the Egyptian participant, can he be charged, can he be censured for this type of unsportsmanlike behavior?
I'm not sure what the sports governing rules say about this kind of behavior, whether simply not shaking hands is enough to be censured. There may well be some sort of castigation saying, you know, that it's not okay. But I doubt very much whether he would get a ban or whether it would be more serious than that. I mean, clearly it's just not sportsmanlike, that's all. I don't think he committed any more significant violations of the rules. But this is just kind of something that's accepted in the sport. It's a bit like bowing when you go onto the mat and when you leave the mat. It's just, you know, this respect that you pay to the sport and to your opponent. And unfortunately, the Egyptian in this particular case, Syed Molle, did not abide by those rules. So I'm not sure that he'll be censured, but I guess we'll wait to see
what is interesting says. Is that his country, of all countries in the Middle East, has actually been at peace with Israel for decades now.
So that is a very interesting thing, because as I said before, you know, at a regime level, at the administration to administration level, there is a huge amount of cooperation. Of course, there are ambassadors that have swapped, and there is a lot of security cooperation, and I think that people would be quite surprised at how closely the two governments are working, the Egyptian and the Israeli governments are working with regard to Gaza and with regard to general things that are happening in the Sinai Peninsula, because the Egyptian military is really struggling, is really stretched to police very adequately what's going on in the Sinai. And as a result of that, the Sinai has the a tendency and the propensity to be like the Wild West, because there is simply no ability to police what's going on there. And that the Egyptian government from time to time does ask the IDF and the Israeli government to help them to take care of things in Sinai, where the Egyptian military is simply unable to do so because they don't have the resources or they don't have the equipment. And there is a lot of cooperation with Israeli forces going into Sinai with the permission of the Egyptians, at the request of the Egyptians, in order to take care of things that are happening there. For Israel, of course, it's in their interest, because the quieter things are on the southern side of the border, the easier it is for southern Israel. So there is a huge amount of cooperation that goes on at that level. But on an individual people-to-people level, unfortunately, that doesn't really work. The Egyptians still have a lot of antagonism towards Israelis. Mm, and that's quite opposite from what we see in Iran, where on an individual level, we see Iranians really wanting to engage with Israelis, but the administration not.
It really is, absolutely is fascinating. Unfortunately, I did want to talk about Benny Gantz's phone being hacked by Russians. We've got a few seconds left. If you can just tell us something about that.
Just very quickly, I mean, this is now the second time that Benny Gantz's phone has been hacked. Originally, a few months ago, we heard that it had been hacked by Iran. Now, apparently, the Russians have hacked it. And I suppose the question is, why would anybody have the interest to hack Benny Gantz's phone, particularly in this time that leads up to the elections? And it's a question that I'm not sure that I really know how to answer. I mean, there is speculation that the Russian government, the Russian administration, Putin in particular, has it in his interest that Netanyahu will be returned to be the prime minister and to of course run the government, and therefore to the extent that others like Benny Gantz may be weakened would be helpful for them. Now, we know that there has been accusations against the Russians for in getting involved in foreign elections. And this may well be one of those cases, but I think the real question for the Israeli cybersecurity world is, how is it that Israeli phones are being hacked by foreign regimes? I think that that's something that we really need to deal with all the cybersecurity that Israel is able to produce.
Absolutely right, Anthony Reich. That's where we leave you. It is 8 o'clock. You have a fantastic weekend, a Shabbat Shalom, and then we'll catch you on Monday morning, same time, same place. It is 8 o'clock. I'm Howard Feldman. A very good morning.